You're listening to Soap Sound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the El Arpa Podcast. So welcome to part one of the show. Joining me in studio for a very special interview is Mary Longstockings, back from her hiatus in Switzerland. How are you?
I'm fine. Apparently I've travelled from...
Switzerland?
No, but that was Sweden, wasn't it? Like she was from...
I don't know, they're all alpine.
You're thinking Heidi, I think.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. And also you've come bearing gifts of massive white Toblerone bars. Thank you very much for that as well. So how was your trip to Switzerland?
It was really good. It was freezing.
Yeah, beautiful photographs. You can check our Instagram for that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, really nice. Really nice time with family.
Okay. Your brother is very upset to see you go. Bestest in the world.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Your nephew loves tickles.
He does.
Yeah. And they're all just bringing a collective sigh of relief because they don't have to worry about Europe.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's they're already at that stage.
Yeah. But
of neutrality.
They also have UEFA there, don't they?
FIFA.
Well, also FIFA, but
yeah.
Is UEFA there as well? I think UEFA could be also in Switzerland.
I don't know. My brother lives right next to FIFA, but I don't know about UEFA.
Yeah.
Well,
of course, for the listener, your brother lost his job when Sepp Blatter lost his job as well.
In fact, no connection there.
Local newspapers refer to him as the brains behind the operation. All the corruption scandals go back to your family.
Wow, thanks. Disclaimer, this is all a joke.
Just in FIFA. So this is the 101st episode and also our last one before Christmas. More of that in part three. We'll be wishing you seasonal salutations. And all that jazz. But Christmas, have you done all your shopping as well?
Pretty much, I think.
Yeah?
No.
Okay. I can give you a bit of a hint on what I've gotten you.
All right.
Yeah, I'll give you some clues before we go to part two. Because part two is actually very meaty and substantial. We're talking about a new movie called Roma, which you've probably heard about. We're going to be talking about colour in photographs, black and white noir movies. Also like famous letters from history as well. And Twitter hashtags as Harvard Citation Footnotes. It is all amazing. before we get to that though. So your clue is, I got you a cup. But the imperfection of a chip is actually a good thing.
Okay.
So what am I talking about?
Red Riding Hood?
Are you deliberately not saying the right answer?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, what is it then?
Well, I'm not going to say.
Well, I know what it is, but for the benefit of the listener.
No, but the listeners don't want to know until after Christmas.
Okay, well, I'll say there's two main characters. One who's like really beautiful and the other is kind of like beastly, I guess. So I'm not sure what if you don't know what movie I'm referring to, then you should anyway. And speaking of your trip to Switzerland as well, you look at confusion there. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I know what you're talking about. Great. I'm just like wondering what you're gonna ask me.
Snow White is what I'm talking about. You listened to the Blind Boy podcast in where he interviewed Bernadette Devlin, and you were quite impressed with the interview style. The whole package basically of the interview, and also the first part before the interview, he was in Spain complaining about the tiles and the sound. As a Spanish person, what did you make of a Limerick man's interpretation of Andalusia?
Well, I have to say, at first, until he mentioned he was in Cordoba, I didn't know where in Spain he was, and I was wondering whether he was in Madrid. Well, he wasn't really specifying.
Well, he said that Cordoba, and he got corrected by someone.
Yeah,
and he has a Spanish clay whistle, which is called an ocarina. And he plays it. I don't think he played it in that podcast.
No, he said he forgot it.
Yeah.
But, he said something about, you know, how all the stuff with the ham and how basically in the south of Spain, like, people put ham in food because it came from the time of the Reconquista, or Reconquista, as he said, yeah, where, you know, Christians were getting the country back from Muslims, and how they did that to make sure, like, you know, they singled you out as Muslims. Which, yeah, that's fair enough. But then he did say something about, like, the color of skin and how they were segregating people by the color of the skin, in the case of Muslims, which I don't think was, like, quite very accurate. But, I mean, the point he was trying to, historically, but, well, in terms, like, of ethnic differences. But,
in terms of the truth.
Yeah, well, no, in terms of, like, because, you know, the color of the skin, like, he was talking about, like, he was linking it to white supremacy, and, well, I didn't think it was a very
compelling argument.
No, it wasn't really. No, it wasn't really a good comparison. I think it's probably out of ignorance, I suppose.
Well,
he does mention. No.
Settle down, Mary. It's a Christmas podcast.
No, he sound like he has a lot of. I was impressed by the fact that he knew some things about Spain, for example. That
well, he goes to Spain every year for a writing holiday.
Yeah, well, I figure from what he said, and yeah, no, that's brilliant that he's trying to. Even if he says he doesn't speak Spanish, but he's trying to pick up on some of those things. But I mean, like, specifically that issue of, like, distinction by color in terms of, like, Christians and Muslims. But I mean, just a minor thing. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, he was using it as a device to introduce the topic. So.
Yeah. Well, no, the blind boy plays fast and loose with the facts sometimes. A lot of hot takes, and not everything he says is going to be 100%. Accurate.
Okay, all right, so.
But it's a hell of a ride, though.
Well, all right, yeah. I mean, it was good. It was the first time I listened to it, and it made me want to listen to other episodes, so obviously that's been effective.
That's true. As I said, yeah, so you can listen to that whatever one you want. He's done 54 or 55, so you've a lot to work with there. And, yeah, I think that's enough for part one.
Sure.
Unless you've anything other Christmas related to talk about.
I could sing a Christmas carol, but
could you?
No.
Okay. Well, Christmas carols aren't very popular in Spain anyway, so I believe.
Well, they are, but just the old fashioned ones, not like these, you know, modern pop.
Yeah. Speaking of Christmas in Spain, trying to explain what a Christmas cracker is to a Spanish student is challenging.
It is quite complicated.
Yeah, I've actually YouTube videos of it as well.
Now, until very recently, you couldn't even show them physically, but now they've started selling them.
Oh,
in
really?
Spain. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, well, at least they know what it's like. They still don't understand what the purpose is, which, to be honest, I don't either.
What do you mean you don't understand what the purpose is? You're the guys who eat like a roscón where it has like a bean in the middle of it.
It's a Roman tradition. If you tell me, like, the cracker thing goes back to, like, Celtic times, then fine.
Goes back to Etruscan times.
Etruscan times?
Yeah.
Are you saying that just because it's just before the Romans, just so that you can be...
No, because I didn't know the Etruscans were before the Romans.
More
as a lucky guess.
What sort of historian are you?
A modern historian.
A modern historian one.
Anyway, God. All right, then. So enough of this nonsense. Part 2 is quite substantial and very interesting, so please join us momentarily for that. But what's up next?
Battle?
Well, a musical interlude.
Oh, okay.
So, welcome to part 2 of the show. Thank you for joining us again after our mini break in the Alps of Switzerland.
Okay.
Those peaky mountains of Toblerone country. So we're going to talk about more culture today of the movie kind. Are you familiar with the director from Mexico, Cuarón? I can't pronounce it properly.
Cuarón.
Yeah, well, that's close.
Yes, I am, but to be honest, I was trying to think of a movie at the top of my head and I couldn't think of any, which is really bad.
He made that space movie with Miss Congeniality.
And
she's also in Speed.
Interstellar. No, Gravity.
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 With Sandra Bullock.
Yeah.
Speaking of Bullocks, how are the cows in Switzerland? is called a segue, dear listener. Well, his new movie is called Roma, which is set for many an Oscar gong, apparently. Many critics describing it as the best movie of the year, and even one reviewer going so far as to say they should just cancel the Oscar nominations from here on in because this is the clear favorite, and I cannot disagree. So this director has made Gravity. He's made other movies as well. And this is basically a story ostensibly about a maid in a well-to-do family. And every reviewer will mention this. And Barry, who is also famous in the podcast, has mentioned it. He's the reason I watch this movie. So thanks again, Bara, Shaklad. So like basically it's an interpretation. Bara Shaklad, that's Irish for...
chocolate.
Bara chocolate, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
But his name, Barry, is Bara, which is also like, it's a pun, basically.
Yeah. I was processing the pun in Irish in my brain.
So if there's one Gael Gore out there who got that and didn't roll their eyes at that weak pun. But no, and so he was like saying, and all the reviewers will say as well, that this is basically loosely based on a director's own childhood and set in a very interesting time in Mexican history as well. Because there's a lot of political and social upheaval, which isn't actually explored very much in the movie, but is very much hinted at around the scenes. And I think it is done very well that way, because the main character is a woman who's never acted before. So this movie reminds me a little bit of Ken Loach's movies, because his social realism, but, you know, his movies, Loach's films, are done in a very raw way, while this is absolutely amazing to look at. There's a YouTube channel called Every Frame of Painting, which analyzes different things about movies. And there are a lot of great movie channels on YouTube that discuss everything from the importance of milk in a movie. It symbolizes innocence, apparently. But Every Frame of Painting is one of these channels. And I mentioned this little kind of segue, because this is how you could describe this movie. Every frame of this is so beautifully constructed. It's like it's a painting, for example. Now... like, you remember watching the Traitor, that documentary on Netflix, no? The Traitor, no? We watched this at my house.
No.
Yes, you did. In Bulgaria, I think.
Oh, The Traitor, yeah. Sorry, I thought you said The Trailer. And then I was thinking, no, I haven't watched the trailer of this movie. Yeah, sure.
Well, it's a commentary. Yeah, it's a little bit like this, because you remember the camera movements, they just kind of pan across. And even going back to Ken Loach, there's a famous scene in And When Shakes the Barley, which is basically the Killmichael ambush, where the camera kind of pans across like that as well. Every kind of construction of the scene is like this. I mean, there are very few close-ups until it actually matters. It's not like a traditional movie where you have someone speaking, then a reaction shot. This is very much a tableau where the camera is a distant observer, seeing all these things unfold in front of it. And in a way as well, that kind of represents this main character, this cleaner, this maid, Cleo, who is an unknown actor, has never acted before, is an Indian from Mexico, and she's also on the outside as well of the family that she's cleaning for, because there's one scene where she's kind of sitting down with the family watching TV, and the wife contrives some task for her to do just to kind of stop her from becoming, you know, too comfortable. And this whole kind of like mise-en-scene, which is basically how every scene is constructed in any movie, from the props to the costumes, is so distinct and so gorgeously done in this film that even talking about it doesn't do it justice. And no matter what review you're going to read about this movie, they're going to talk about this primarily. A few standout scenes. I mean, in a way, when you think of Latin American culture, you think of magic realism, true literature. And even though this movie is very natural, there's like a hint of like magic to it as well. It's filmed in a very peculiar style as well. It's filmed in black and white, which I think, I mean, you remember the story I wrote for a competition recently, you know?
Yes, I do.
And the reason I bring it up is because I showed you the instructions for it. It had to be unheimlich.
Oh, yeah.
Dreamlike, memories popping up like ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And things like this. I had no idea what he was looking for, basically. But you can listen to you can read the story in our blog, IrishLice, of Madrid.wordpress.com. And he was actually quite happy with it, to be fair. So I somehow fluked it. But the reason I bring it up is because I think black and white movies have a certain character that really allow for beautiful filmmaking and very symbolic filmmaking in a way that sometimes color films don't, you know, they don't have that capacity sometimes. I think as well it really suits the style, because in a way, not only is it the black and white, but even just the kind of the dreamlike sequences. And I don't mean like there are sequences where people are dreaming, but they're just so caught in the moment, as if the internal motivations of the characters, the internal life of the character, that rich inner life that all the characters have in a well-told story, that they're being carried away by ghosts of memories that kind of pop up. And this whole movie is an examination of his past, which has been rendered through this kind of black and white filter, which is, you know, it's kind of sweeping, it's grand, it's huge, it's a huge scale, it's an epic in a way, but also just kind of like a trance-like investigation, because that's what it's like when you're experiencing this oneness of vision, you know, when you're kind of in the moment but then thinking of other things, or all these things are coming together that seem kind of insignificant, but for one character or a few of you are looking at it, kind of jumps up into something kind of grander, you know. And that's a great aspect of the story, because in reality nothing really happens. And even though you have well, I won't give any spoilers, but there are a few dramatic moments in their personal lives. One reviewer even said that the story, I mean, it was kind of redundant in a way, because it's just about things that happen on a daily basis for these characters. And as I mentioned before, they kind of refer to political and social things that are happening around his family life, but they're not really explored in the movie, which makes sense, because the character herself, God bless you, we need to use that mute button more often. She's like, you know, she's not a person who has a lot of stake in Mexican society, so what they're fighting for wouldn't really have much of an impact on her anyway. So I think by not showing that, in a way it's kind of showing a lot as well, if that makes sense. But I think it's just a movie that needs to be seen, because it's very well acted, very emotional, and very beautiful to look at as well, just beautifully constructed. Now, some people don't like black and white movies. How do you feel about them?
I think I like them very much. Of course, it depends on the movie.
That's true.
I think some movies don't suit it at all, but it's true that certain atmospheres are kind of favored by black and white.
Well, film noir is the great example of that, because I mentioned to you before I watched Touch of Evil, Charlton Heston, Orson Welles, sorry. I got my Hollywood fact greats mixed up there for a second. But like, the shadows are richer in black and white movies, even like things like Vertigo, there's so much that can be done cinematically or through the photography of the movie because it's black and white. And basically, even something like Touch of Evil, like, characters are kind of dressed half black, half white, with like one side of their face lit up and the other kind of shrouded in darkness, which is a very obvious symbolism as well for how these characters have a good side and a dark side as well. So black and white has a great capacity to tell a story. So I don't know, are you intrigued to see it after this, what is it,
yeah,
9 minutes of an explanation of it?
I'm,
you know,
definitely intrigued, but I'm just I'm curious about how come it's on Netflix. Like, you're saying that, you know, people tip it to be like an Oscar winner and all that. How come it wasn't released in the cinema?
I think it is released in cinemas. I think it is also. But I think I've seen posters for it. I think I looked at the cartelera, the kind of screen times of different cinemas, and it's been listed there, but it's also on Netflix. Why is it on Netflix? Not only are reviewers like bowled away by how great the movie is, but they're also saying as well, it's kind of a common refrain that this movie should not exist, or it also raises the question of how like Hollywood moguls still earn a living. And when they say it shouldn't exist, it's not a criticism, it means it's so beautiful and so amazing as a movie that, like, how is it made at all, because like most movies don't reach this level of greatness, you know.
Well, it's quite refreshing, because in recent years we haven't seen any, well, we haven't seen many like outstanding movies, you know, kind of when we talk about big Hollywood productions, for example.
Yeah, I mean, one word I'd use about the movies is courageous, because just, you know, doing research for this as well a little bit, there's other movies obviously that use this style where the camera definitely takes a step back, and it takes a lot of courage to do that, because you'd have to really commit to letting the camera linger. And obviously, you know, it's not a case of just turning on the camera and see what happens. You have to, you know, conspire the situation as well and act it, you know, and write it, of course. Now, in this particular movie, the actors were only given the script, like on the day of filming, to make it, I guess, more natural, which is something approaching what Ken Loach does as well. But just, you know, I mean, but the fact is just, you know, the opening scenes is like a floor being washed, but just the waves of the water over this hallway, which is covered in dog excrement, you know, and there's like this plane flying over it's a reflection of the plane and caught in the water as well. So there's all these moments where they're just heavy with kind of meaning and symbolism, and it's done very, very, very well, you know. It's just a very restrained but also full of detail kind of story, and I'd really recommend watching it, you know, because but yeah, I don't know, I think there's not much more I can say about it, really.
What about the music, because we always...
I was just going to say the music as well, yeah.
Okay.
As far as I know, there's actually not... I can't remember actually the music. If there's music in the movie, it's completely... I've overlooked it, but it's interesting, though, because like the dialogue, in a way, is almost muted. It's kind of hard to hear what they're saying sometimes, which is also kind of the blur of everyday conversations.
But is it in Spanish?
It's in Spanish, and also this dialect that the maids speak to each other as well, for example. And... but there's also, like, you know, like noises of people protesting or people marching. So there's like a suggestion of life happening outside the family life. You know, there's a kind of things are moving. But because the characters themselves maybe aren't really aware of it because they're kind of bourgeoisie, you know, the viewer themselves aren't aware of it either. And because the maid isn't going to be affected by any social change either, we're not also, for that reason, not really aware of it. But a lot of the noises that happen in the movie are kind of incidental in a way, where they're kind of on the street and there's a character moving along making a noise, and that is the music of the street in a way, you know. So it's kind of an interesting movie for that, you know. So if there is music, I can't remember what it was, you know. And like a lot of greatly fantastically choreographed scenes that if you just pause the movie, you can make a poster out of it and put it on your wall. And it would be a fantastic image to have on your wall, you know. So, and that's I know it sounds like a maybe flippant thing or a facetious thing, but it's kind of designed of like a visually arresting movie that you could just pause anywhere. It would be an image that you could look at, and it would be aesthetically and pleasing, and also telling some kind of story as well, you know.
Well, that sounds amazing, I have to say.
Yeah, it's really, really good. But speaking of colors as well, because we were talking a little bit today as well about this BBC history podcast, which is about kind of like, I guess, you know, color and its use in movies, but also in historical photographs as well. Mm-hmm. So have you ever seen historical photographs with color infused into them? And what was your reaction upon seeing them?
Well, I think we've kind of come across it before a little bit. And I think a few months ago there was a thing about it on Twitter of a particular photo that was quite striking, because it was really old, but it just seemed to be like from yesterday, basically, the way it was coloured.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you mentioned Twitter, because this is a new book, and actually there's a few... It's a great industry that the British History Magazine podcast has, because they're basically selling books as well through the podcast, interviewing the authors. Anthony Beaver, it's not Anthony Beaver, it's Simon Sebag Montefiore. His book is the one he's edited, but World Letters. And another guy has done this book in collaboration with an artist, well, also an amateur history blogger, with these photographs of full colour. And he, like, just saw it on Twitter. He's supposed to be writing a book about the Templars, and was just procrastinating, lurking on Twitter by his own admission, and saw it, and then contacted his agent saying, sign this girl up now before anybody else does, you know. It's an amazing podcast, because the girl interviewing them sounds like she's just, like, in heaven, surrounded by these history people. She can't stop giggling. And then the guy himself keeps making jokes that are funny. So it's kind of like a more dynamic BBC podcast history.
Okay, that's unusual.
than other ones. Yeah, it's quite strange, but in a good way. And so it's just like, a lot of criticisms they say, well, they've received, is that you're kind of misrepresenting history with the color, but they say we've done a lot of research into it, and we know what the colors are for the most part, and anyway the black and white photograph is still there. But what they do talk about though is that it just, there's just an emotional register there with these photographs that doesn't exist with black and white ones, that like it just, something is different, it breaks through a wall there when you see a color photograph. And I think that is very true in my case. I guess you've also experienced that, no?
Yeah, definitely. I think, well, it just sort of like brings them to, I think before this we saw a few images, a few historical images that were, it's kind of like, I would say a similar effect to those ones that are in the same location and then part of the photo is like current day and then the other part is historical. Do you remember?
Yeah.
We saw them some time ago.
I remember that, yeah.
And that helps you kind of like identify more with the photo. And I think color is the same in a way, because black and white, as much as we've said that for the movies, it creates an atmosphere and all that, I think when it's something static, then probably knowing exactly what color its thing is helps it feel more current.
Well, apparently there's a photograph of Queen Victoria in the book where she's wearing a white dress, and the illustrator, not the illustrator, but the person who's in charge of applying the colors said, like, this is amazing because we always think of Queen Victoria wearing a black dress in mourning for Albert. But she is a beautiful dress. It's stunning.
And it wasn't black.
No, it was white. And
really?
And also, apparently, I think she might be young in that photograph, but the whole effect is that she looks amazing. And it's just a new way to see Queen Victoria, you know. And I love when historical queens have great fashion sense as well, so.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, like, I mean, if you were impressed by a picture of Queen Victoria, then it must have been really...
I haven't seen it. I'm just paraphrasing her. If I buy that book, which I do want to buy that book, clang, Christmas present hint dropped right there. I will not be jumping straight to that page for sure.
I can imagine that.
But it's what it is like... It is amazing though, because apparently, well, they're in Waterstone, so I think they're at some kind of book signing maybe. So they're doing an interview there, and then people interrupt and ask for autographs. And one guy when they weren't recording, said like his two children, who are quite young, really adore the photographs as well. And the guys, there's a guy and a girl basically who are behind the book. The guy is an established historian who's published other books before. He says quite a challenge to get people interested in history, and that is quite true, as we both know. And there's an age when people are maybe more susceptible to developing an interest in something, because very often what can happen is people don't really look at history until they're maybe older or retired, and then develop their interest in it. But that's a huge part of your life where that's history's not a factor, you know. But things like these color photographs that make it more immediate and make these people. Well, people, I guess, in the eyes of the reader, potentially could have a huge benefit for people getting more actively involved in history and caring about it more, which is something that we're both passionate about. I thought as well, like, in terms of the technique was interesting, because you talk about the technique of translating. And even though they're two different disciplines, like, there's a lot of similarities in kind of applying the scientific process to maintaining the accurate voice of the person, either whether it be in a text or in a photograph, as well, wouldn't you think?
Yes, definitely. Well, okay, that's an interesting comparison.
I think it's really great. Yeah, it sounds like, I haven't seen any picture from the book, to be honest, but okay. It just sounds like an amazing collection. Even like, it's just fascinating as well, because I assume as well, she said like there's some photographs, there's Mussolini, by the description of the photograph, I think I know exactly what they're talking about, when he's strung up from a lamppost, he's just been murdered basically.
Mm-hmm.
And she spent like, with each photograph, you spend like a long time putting the colors in, so you do establish this emotional relationship with the photograph as well. So, and with some, it's easier to do that than with others, I guess, in terms of, she probably develops that emotional attachment with every photograph, but it's less taxing when it's a dress from Queen Victoria,
yeah,
and more exhausting when it's something like, when it's like a dictator who's just been, who's lost his life very recently before taking that photograph was taken. Mm-hmm. So, So that's a movie and a book that you can both consume there in your free time.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. And do you want to hear about letters?
Sure. Tell me about the letters.
No, it's just not. Well, we're coming to 20 minutes here on part two, but we can continue a little bit on, I think. Well, you mentioned you love letters.
Do I know?
I think you do, yeah. What do you know about Egyptian letters?
Well, I think we mentioned some Egyptian...
We certainly did, yeah.
...correspondence with kings from the Near East, basically. Yeah. And how it was funny because they had, like, this very personal characteristics of, like, even humor. Some of them have a little bit of humor and... just human emotions in general, so that's quite peculiar. But I think historically there are some interesting letters, for example, between intellectuals or writers or things like that. So I don't know if that's what this is about.
Well, it's basically everybody. There's a few funny stories. Well, there's one, this isn't a funny story, but it's an interesting one where Mahatma Gandhi wrote letters to Hitler, who never replied.
Never.
So it's like... wow. Yeah, which is interesting, but... there's one woman who was the mistress of Bolivar, and she was engaged to be married or already married to an Englishman, and she decided to, well, look, I don't want to be with this English guy anymore, so she wrote like the most horrendous letter anybody could ever write. You know, you make jokes without laughing, you make love without pleasure, you do this and you do that. And surely when I see, we'll be married again in heaven because heaven's made for boring people. And I wish I could honor Bolivar more by leaving a better class of men or something like
that. Well, that's nice. That's...
yeah, well, it's incredible. But but you get like a lot of love poems, obviously, but also, sharing ideas. And what's also interesting as well is like what it means outside of the book itself, because like Simon Sebag Montefiore... is kind of talking about this, like, I like saying that name, but he
I've noticed, like, I always like find it so hard to remember, but you seem to
okay. For me it's easy to remember, it's very distinctive.
Montefiore.
It's Montefiore.
It's really funny because then like he's so British, I mean,
yeah, well,
you know? So it's funny he has that surname.
Yeah, I don't, I'd love to know, I'm just thinking where he's from, but then because of Brexit maybe there'll be a profiling of him. he'll be a smart database.
Well, I think once he did a series on like kind of like Florence painters or something like that, and there's some sort of like link there with I can't remember exactly who. Well, obviously I suppose his mother.
Oh really? Yeah,
yeah, but the, yeah, I mean, he knows a lot about like the Renaissance and stuff.
Yeah. Like that. What I love about these two podcasts as well, like he was left it too late to kind of like write the book in a way, and he got his 17-year-old daughter to kind of like pick letters to put in the book, and then the guy who's doing the book about the photographs is like, oh yeah, she'll do most of the work. Yeah, his partner. I'll just rattle off the captions and the train, and it, like, I'll do it in a few weeks. Took 2 years of extensive research and 10,000 photographs to be whittled down to 200. So kind of like, you know, I think we can relate to that hodgepodge last year stuff. But no, what's interesting, like outside of what the, you know, the letters are about or what the photographs are about, even though both are a comprehensive history in their own way of a huge span of history, even like Mark Antony makes a feature as well. He's writing letters to the Roman Emperor who's criticizing him for or the soon to be Roman Emperor for like basically being the lover of Cleopatra as well. So you know, like aside the significance of the letters themselves and what they say about history, like Simon Sebag Montefiore likes
how many times has he put it in a podcast?
It'd be
in
the title of the podcast as well. Hopefully he'll see it. But no, he loves letters, and I think do you like a good letter?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, good. But
I haven't had a letter for a long time. Come on.
I'll write you a letter on Christmas Day. But okay. But he talks about how like you know, when you write a letter, there's more significance behind the words, and you care about it more when you receive it as well. That that permanence isn't there with electronic emails. Oh, yeah. But he thinks like that people will, and also he kind of says like for future historians, you know, it'll be difficult to harvest information like the way he's been able to harvest information from these letters. And also that by seeing security risks with email, people will probably go back to letters. Now, in that second part about the security, I can see that happening, but I think we've already seen with the movement for repealing the Eighth Amendment in Ireland, basically giving abortion rights to women, that there's a huge, there are historians kind of compiling Twitter documents. Exactly. Yeah, threads, yeah. And also, like, you see all these, like, you know, emails, you know, Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, was using personal email, Hillary Clinton using personal email. Mm-hmm. So, like, a lot of information is, like, and scandals have come out from tweets or from emails as well. So I believe historically, you know, as a historian, or someone who studied history, that rather than a historian, but
I are a historian. Come on,
With a small H, but title. Yeah, well, I do my MPhil.
MPhil for sure.
Almost like a PhD.
I know.
So that probably it will be a rich vein of information in the future. I don't know what you think about that, though. I mean, do you think historians of the future will be able to harvest this from digital sources in a way they've been able to do that from paper sources all along until now?
Well, I was telling you the other day about this student of mine who's a teenager, and he was saying he didn't have any photos when he was a baby because they were all digital.
Yeah.
So that was the first time that it struck me that, you know, maybe these things could get lost. But I remember, like, when I first started receiving emails, my brother was living in Florida, and then I would always print out the emails. And I kept them, I still have them.
Yeah, and your mother loves printing out the photographs from the computer as well, no?
Well, no, she's just forever complaining that we don't print them out for her. But yeah, I don't know to what extent it would be possible to save them. I mean, I think I probably have emails in my inbox like since like probably 2008 or something like that.
Well, yeah, me too, yeah. You don't go back and read, obviously.
That I haven't deleted.
And even the search function, because, like, there's emails I know that are there from maybe 2008, but even searching for them in the inbox, that doesn't really yield, like, a lot of results. I don't think the filters are really refined for...
I think it's definitely a historian or, like, history-involved people feature that we don't delete any emails at all, you know? There's a whole archive there, a personal archive there.
That and laziness, I think.
You could actually, like, trace your life for the past 10 years.
Yeah. Well, that's what the whole point is, yeah.
So, exactly. So, it is a historical document. Yeah. So, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's all, like, so ephemeral, I guess.
I guess it'll be a chapter on every future autobiography, no? Entitled Spam.
Junk folder.
Junk folder, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That's yet to be seen, I guess, but...
Did Donald Trump need Cialis? Check his junk folder. Okay, heavy silence after that.
No, I was just thinking of, like, whether, to what extent things or emails have been preserved, or just what you were saying before, because the thing with Twitter is that, you're right, maybe some Twitter threads have been preserved and so on, but then, well, it's moving so fast. There's a new controversy every half an hour.
Yeah.
So whether that's going to be kept in the memory, I mean, probably, like, they'll end up doing some sort of archiving library project of digital interactions, which to a point there's already, like, the odd thing for specific disciplines. Like, for example, for archaeology, there are some, like, digitalizing projects of, like, social media and stuff like that.
Well, already,
so probably they'll do that.
Well, in a way, and I've just thought of this, but this is brilliant.
Even if you say it to yourself.
I mean, the hashtag is basically the footnote of Twitter. So, I mean, you already have marketing people tracking the engagements of certain hashtags. Like, sharing is better, Sainsbury, Christmas, 2016.
There's only one difference with that.
What's that?
That nobody reads the footnotes.
Well, but historians do. So people can find this, like, we'll be able to see probably hashtag, you know, Black Lives Matter or whatever, and see, like, metrics that a marketer would use, but also they could apply that same information in a historical context as well, probably. I don't know. Yeah, that's brilliant, no?
Yeah, well, why don't you get on with it? I mean, it's a good idea. You might as well. Now you've just told the entire world, so probably somebody will steal it.
Well, yeah, I don't think you can patent history, but anyway, well, before the matter of making our own history, we have the small matter of part 3. So if you are very kind, dear listener, please join us momentarily in that part, unless you have anything more to add.
Nope.
Oh, well, that was very fast. All right then. So, part three of the show. So, just a little reminder for you. This is our 101st episode. Also, our last one before Christmas. So, we're going to be taking a Christmas hiatus for 2 weeks. So, probably you'll get your next podcast on January 10th, which is the first Thursday of January. So, you can also listen to our back catalogue, of course, if you miss our voices. Or listen to this on repeat if you want. I know I messaged this like last week as well for the 100th episode. But any highlights between last week's episode and this week's episode?
In life in general?
No, in the podcast. you really loved how I made an editing goof on the link between part two and part three.
No, I didn't love it. I just...
I know, I was being ironic.
I just pointed it out.
Yeah, yeah. That's another hashtag for Twitter. LRPA mistakes, podcast goofs.
Hashtag off the camera.
If we... Right, so that's one a week for like how many before? Like 6 months, no? So 4 by 6, that's 24, isn't it?
It is 24.
Yeah. Okay, so before the summer hiatus, we'll do maybe 130-140 episodes.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're like, you know, it's stuff in July and August as well. Okay, that's kind of amazing. So that means in 2.5 years we'll be back. We'll be episode 200. That's amazing. Well, you've been listening to us, of course,
and so on.
And if we do for 10 years. But if you are listening to us for our 400 episode and all that in the future, you should be doing it on any platform that you want, because at the end of the day, listening is most important to us. But on one special platform, you can help us a little bit. And Mary, take it away.
Radio Public. I'll be listening now.
A little bit louder?
Radio Public, yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. And what happens there with Radio Public?
Well, that you help us support what we do. And, yeah, or... okay, you help support what we do, or you help us do what we do best.
Okay.
Yeah, that's probably
it. Okay, just to translate that. Yeah. By listening to us, you generate... we get paid listens, basically, if you listen to us on Radio Public.
That sounds really cool.
No, we gotta make an honest living, don't we?
But you know, it's like Radio Public, the radio, the people, you know, you don't have to pay, and then you help us, so we'll win, you know, the people.
But if you really like the content, you kind of want to pay for it as a mark of appreciation.
Then you can go to Patreon.
That's also true, and also on Radio Public, but also if you don't, couldn't be bothered, it'll be continuing anyway for free, so... That's the worst sales marketing pitch ever. Over with.
I was going to say, we're not good for marketing.
So while you mentioned Patreon, you can also find us on Instagram and Twitter. LARPA1 is our Twitter handle. LARPA is our Instagram one. And you can find us on our blog, as I mentioned in part two, irishsliceofmadrid.wordpress.com. But stay tuned, though, because we'll be paying actual money for that blog in January. Now it'll become irishsliceofmadrid.com, simply.
Wow.
What an upgrade.
We're feeling rich.
All right, then. Well, I think that is everything for this 101st episode. Thank you very much for listening for this bumper one. Have a very, very, very Merry Christmas and have a Happy New Year.
And a Merry Christmas.
And a Merry Christmas. Oh, wait. Yeah. The LARPA Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.